touched the walls. As he walked, however, the cave became smaller and smaller. Though it felt like the walls were closing around him, he still went forward. Finally, when the cave was so small that there was just enough room for the height and width of a single man, he stepped out the other side. Aha! Maiden opened her arms wide. Before him lay cultivated rice and tea fields, people working and laughing, children and dogs playing. Well, old Jew thought he must be dreaming. He hadn't seen such harmony and calm in years. Nevertheless, he continued down into the village. If he was dreaming, he hoped not to wake any time soon. He approached a group of people dressed in a style he had never seen. They asked where he had come from. As he explained, he learned that the people of this plentiful valley had never heard of the Han or the Wei, let alone the Jin. Their forefathers had fled the chaos during the Age of Qin. They had lived there ever since, cut off from the outside world. The villagers brought out wine to toast their guest and killed a chicken for a feast, entreating old Ju to stay. There was singing and merrymaking into the night. Meilin pauses. Renshu looks expectantly at her. The passenger turns around. He has long whiskers and merry eyes. Liver spots speckle his cheeks. He takes out a cigarette and listens openly, leaning back on his elbows. Then what? Renshu asks. Meilin stalls, remembering now more clearly how the story goes. Making a decision, Meilin concludes, after several days and several feasts, old Zhu decided to stay in the village and make it his home. He was happy in Peach Blossom Spring. Why would he want to leave a land of peaceful plenty?
Really? That's a strange ending.
Renshu is skeptical.
What do you mean? It's a nice ending. It seemed like one more thing should happen. A joke, or a tragedy, or a lesson?
Renshu suggests. Meilin shrugs.
No, that's it. The end.
Renshu narrows his eyes.
Maybe I am getting too old for your stories after all, he says.
He rises and goes towards the other side of the boat.
There is more to that story, you know,
murmurs the passenger, putting out his cigarette.
I know, sighs Meilin.
Then she gathers her basket and walks away. The river is widening, pushing its banks back, changing into the broad waterway that expands across the plains, stretching to the east. Meilin hasn't told Renshu her plan. He is young, and she knows how secrets can leak even from closed mouths. It's better if he only knows once it's happening. At Yitang, they disembark. Again, all around are groups of exhausted thin faces, surrounded by meagre possessions. Long Wei is arranging tickets for the next steamer. Wen Ling and Li Fen sit on their cases, listless. As no one is watching her, Meilin starts sorting through her basket. She lifts her box of jade charms and coins, trying not to make a sound. She opens it. Only a handful of valuables remain, enough to cover the bottom of the box. To muffle their jingling, she crams in some scraps of cloth. Her hand rests on the scrolls box at the bottom of the basket. Squinting at the cold, clear sky, she puts on a jumper, her thickest socks and a hat. In the spaces she's vacated, she stows a box of matches, a small sack of rice, and a block of tea. In the middle section of the basket, she folds a warm coverlet. The top, as always, holds her spools, needles, and scissors. Once again, she's ready. Meilin picks up her basket and goes to Renshu.
Come, let's go to the market. Wear your coat. These days turn cold quickly.
Why do you have your basket?
We'll get oranges for the journey. Put your coat on, she repeats.
Their conversation has caught Wen Ling's interest.
There is no time for a market trip, grumbles Long Wei, who has just returned with a fistful of tickets.
It's been such a long time since we had oranges, Wen Ling wheedles, and everyone knows Yitang oranges have the best flavour.
Sensing Long Wei's resolve weakening, Wen Ling tries another tactic.
Meilin knows the city. She can be quick.
Meilin stays silent as Long Wei considers. She is counting on Wenling's fondness for fruit and Longwei's tendency to indulge her.
Don't delay, he scowls. The steamer will arrive soon. If you're late, we'll leave without you.
I know, says Maylin. Once in the city, Maylin finds that her feet remember the shortcuts to the market. She moves quickly. Renchu struggles to keep up. She doesn't want to pause. She fears if she lets herself see what has been damaged, what has been lost, she will lose focus. At a fruit stall, she buys an armful of oranges. Here, Maylin says, handing Renchu a tin pot she has just purchased from a neighbouring stall. We'll carry them in this. Then she bargains with a man selling snow pears. Once she has filled the few remaining gaps in her basket with pears, she studies the hillside.
Will we go back now, Ma?
Soon, she murmurs, and starts walking across the market away from the docks. He looks back at the boats, then hurries to catch up to her.
Ma, we need to go back.
The boat's not here yet, she says, without turning to look. I just want to see if I can find something.
What are you looking for?
He has now caught up.
Ma, a big steamer has reached the port. Look!
Maylin glances.
Yes, but it will take time to dock and then unload and load. It might not even be our boat. We've been on the water for so many days. Let's stretch our legs a little longer.
She walks faster now and turns onto a road heading uphill.
Ma! Renchu grabs her arm. We have to go. We have to go back to our family.
Maylin twists her arm free. When did he become so strong?
Renchu, you have family here. My parents. Your Waigong and Waipo.
Waigong? Waipo?
You don't remember them, but they met you when you were little with your baba. When the war came, we couldn't see them again. Now that the war is over, let's go find them.
His mouth drops open in disbelief. Maylin keeps talking.
We need to let Uncle and Auntie and Lifeng go to Shanghai. We... The boy's eyes brim with tears as he takes in what she is saying. He starts running down the hill towards the docks. Oranges bounce out of the pot as he goes. He hunches his arm awkwardly over the top and continues, but when the steamer's horn signals its departure, his shoulders drop and he slows, bursting into sobs. Maylin runs after him, gathering the fallen fruit. When she reaches him, she drops the fruit and folds him into her arms, caressing his hair. She doesn't say, "We'll see them again," or "It's just for a short time," or give any other sort of false comfort. She just lets him cry until he exhausts his tears. Then she puts the oranges back in the pot, one by one. They watch in silence as the steamer heads downriver with Longwei, Wenling, Lifeng, and many others, but not with them. Maylin hopes she's made the right decision. Come, Renchu. Maylin picks up her basket and hands him the pot. We need to keep going. The dirt road rises into the hills. The day is warm and the path is steep. With each step, Maylin's sense of cautious optimism grows into elation. Finally! After all these years, she has been bold, not timid. She is on her way home. Her heart is glad. Renchu drags behind, kicking at the dust. After 20 minutes, he says he's tired and hungry. She sits down on a rock overlooking the valley and pats a spot next to her. They have climbed far and quickly. It's good to rest. Maylin reaches into her basket and offers him a snow pear. He won't meet her gaze, but he does take the pear. It is round, with tiny white freckles on a golden translucent skin. He takes a bite, crisp like water chestnuts. Maylin takes one for herself. The sweet juice slakes her thirst.
Save your seeds, she instructs.
They follow a winding path through a thick bamboo forest, clacking a welcome in the wind. Soon, Maylin recognizes a grove of trees. She rushes to examine them. Among the stumps, a few still grow. Maylin tugs down a branch and pulls off a stiff, waxy leaf. It is red, mottled with spots of green and yellow.
Camphor, Maylin says. We use the oils for medicines. Also good for keeping away moths.
Why have some been cut down?
It's tradition to plant a camphor tree each time a baby girl is born. The tree and the girl grow together. That way, with a glance, the village matchmaker sees how many daughters a family has and will know when they are old enough to be married. When one of the daughters gets engaged, the family cuts down the tree to make a trunk for her wedding dowry.
Did you have a camphor trunk, Ma?
Yes, I did, Malin says softly. The landscape is calling to Malin. She knows these hills and cliffs. Beyond are the mountains of her youth. As a girl, she spent many summers here with her grandparents while her parents tended the shop in the city below. She breathes in the scent of pines, becoming more and more certain that the thick tree cover will have shielded her village from any bombs. Every overgrown path assures her that the remote settlement would have been missed by marching troops. Her father will be outside, gazing up, not in fear of planes, but reading the patterns of the clouds. Her mother will be worrying over which greens to feed their oxen. They will welcome her home. Yet, something doesn't seem right. They haven't seen any others on this road. Malin keeps expecting to encounter a goat herd and his flock, or to hear the uneven roll of cartwheels on gravel. The farms are still, the tea fields too quiet. Something is missing. It's been 8 years of war, she reasons. Of course there will be changes. She's optimistic, but not foolish. But as they continue, her foreboding grows. When they pass a dilapidated pig pen, Malin realizes, the animals. Where are the braying donkeys and grunting pigs? No whiff of male goats peppers the air. No chickens have been fussing and cackling in the road. She fills the quiet with talk about her family's cottage, their livestock, the brook with sweet water. She tells Renshu about the thump, thump, thump she'd hear some mornings when Farmer Liao's wife beat out the rugs, looking for the coins that fell from his pockets when he drank too much wine the night before. She reminisces about weaving bamboo leaves into mats for drying tea, about the deafening rush of rainfall in these forests during monsoons. Rounding the final corner, she sees scorched patches of ground where wooden structures once stood, only half their walls remaining. There are piles of rubble, but no people. She shakes her head in disbelief. Impossible! She must have made a wrong turn. This must be some other unfortunate village. But when her eyes trace the shape of the hills on the horizon and the bend of the river down below, Malin sees the landscape she committed to memory years ago. Her mistake is not that she lost her way. Her mistake is that she dreamed this place would be untouched. Her basket falls to the ground as her grip loosens. Not here. Not here. She races past the abandoned pens, beyond the shattered stone walls to the ancestors' tombs. She can't see the shrines at the end of the terrace. There should be bright red lanterns hanging on poles and banners flying in the breeze. Even if the fresh fruit and flowers aren't there, the banners will be. Even if no longer bright but faded and threadbare, they will be there. But at the foot of the shrines, Malin finds no flowers, no fruit, no banners. The tombs and family tablets have been smashed to pieces, scattered into piles of rubble. She falls to her knees and combs through the wreckage, looking for fragments of a name, a character, anything. She digs and digs. Nothing has been left intact. Her hands are chafed and bleeding from her efforts. Fury and grief surge through her blood, gathering in her throat. She bursts out, howling a pain beyond words. She forgets the boy, forgets where she is, who she is, and collapses to the ground. As long as this place was safe, and her parents were living, and the ancestors well tended, Malin could bear anything, travel any distance. But now, all is lost. Renshu has been watching with dismay. The moment they rounded the corner and his ma fell silent, he knew something was wrong. His pulse had raced in fear as she turned in a slow circle. When she dropped her basket and ran towards the tombs, he followed helplessly. Now he stands, stunned to see his ma wailing on the ground. Shaken, he picks up her basket. He brings it over and sits beside her. There is little light left. It's getting cold. From the basket, he takes out the wool coverlet and wraps it around her shoulders. He has never seen her like this. In his memory, she is always humming, sewing, cooking, walking, telling stories. Even during the war, she always knew what to do next. For the first time ever, his ma looks small and sad. Renju rubs her back with his open palm, the way she would for him when he was sick or upset. As darkness falls, her sobs recede, but she doesn't speak. He reaches his arm around her to keep them both warm. It's cold, but the sky is clear. Above the silhouettes of the trees, he sees more glittering stars than he ever has before. It has been two full days. Renju watches over his ma as best he can, but she is locked in a grief he cannot penetrate. He has made a shelter near the ruins, a small area in which to sit and rest, using fallen branches for cover. From the stream, he collects fresh water and coaxes her to drink from a broken teacup he found in the rubble. Each night, he builds a small fire to cook rice and brew tea. The embers offer little warmth. Later, he holds her close, soothing her turbulent dreams. When day comes, he tries to give her the remaining oranges. She barely takes a bite before pushing the fruit away. Though the sun is bright, the temperature is dropping. Soon, the first snows will arrive. Their padded jackets and coverlets won't keep out the frost. Their provisions are almost gone. They cannot stay. Renju must find a way to get to Yitang. And then what? A boat downriver to Shanghai to look for uncle? A boat back to Chongqing? He doesn't know, but they must go somewhere else, to a place where Mei Lin will wake from this trance and be his ma again. This morning, she sleeps peacefully after another restless night. He covers her with his jacket and rises to stretch his legs. Usually, when she rests, he doesn't venture far, wanting to be within earshot. But today, instead of turning back when he reaches the edges of the settlement, he continues into the forest. Light filters through the thick trees. A clearing lies ahead. Curious, he draws near and discovers a grove of ancient trees. Many are disfigured and bent with age, their branches wild and untended. Venturing closer, he discovers they are pear trees. Some still bear fruit. Renju finds a few pears that haven't yet fallen. He will bring them to Mei Lin. In his pocket, he fingers the small brown pear seeds his ma told him to save on the way up. He pulls them out and studies them. They look like russet-coloured drops of rain. Or tears. On impulse, he grabs a stick, digs a small hole, and places the seeds inside. He covers them with soft earth and pats the ground. Kneeling by the stream, he cups his hands together. With dripping handfuls, he waters the seeds. He squints up at the sun. Then, Renju gathers his new pears and heads back. Mei Lin is still asleep. Renju opens her basket. Inside are their clothes, the scroll, and her box of treasures. It is much lighter than he remembers. Inside, he finds a handful of coins and charms. Mei Lin stirs. He pockets a few gold coins and the jade charm, then puts the lid back. It will be enough, he thinks. When Mei Lin opens her eyes, he pours cups of water on her hands to wash away the dirt and dried blood. He moistens the cloth of his shirt and wipes her face clear of smudged tears. Drink. He puts the cup in her hands. Eat. He gives her small bites of pear. She sits and shakes her head, staring at the remains of her home. Come, Ma, he insists. We need to go where it will be warmer and safer. He helps her to her feet. He carries her basket and their bedding. She leans on him. She doesn't speak. He gently leads her away. All the way down the mountain, Mei Lin follows Renju. Although he doesn't know how to find Yitang, he figures that as long as they go downhill, they will eventually reach the river. There, he will buy boat tickets. They will find Uncle in Shanghai. He'll explain that they got lost in the market. He'll say they are sorry. Everything will be fine. They will be safe again. By afternoon, they are in the city. He trades the jade charm for food for the journey. At the docks, he finds a man selling tickets. Renshu says they want to go to Shanghai.
"Tickets are very expensive,"
the man says, and looks past him to the next customers. Renshu stays there. The man turns and sees him again.
"You still here? How much do you have?"
Renshu shows the man the 2 gold coins from his pocket. The man's eyes narrow.
"Yes, yes, this boat will take you there,"
the man says, snatching the coins and thrusting some papers into Renshu's hands. Boarding the boat, Renshu dismisses the nagging sense that he might have been cheated. It doesn't matter, he thinks. They are headed to Uncle. Meilin says yes to whatever Renshu suggests. Sometimes, without warning, she starts to sob. Then she'll remain mute for days. Renshu doesn't know how to comfort her. She doesn't look like his ma. She looks like a lost child, with her hair in oily strands falling around her shoulders and her tunic torn and dirty. Her eyes, usually alert and quick, don't focus on anything. Renshu takes out the scroll. Opening to the mountain peaks, he invokes Li Qi and her bravery in slaying the serpent. Then he finds a lone fisherman on a river. This must be old Wu, headed to Peach Blossom Spring. But when he starts retelling the story about the man who lost his horse, Renshu cannot think of any blessings, so he stops. Meilin doesn't seem to notice. One morning, Renshu wakes to the sound of clinking coins. Meilin is going through her box, counting and recounting, muttering and shaking her head. She has washed her face and pulled her hair into a bun.
"Ma, what is it?"
he asks.
2 gold pieces are missing."
Her voice is clear and angry.
"Ma," he reminds her, "I used them for the boat tickets." "2 pieces? 2 pieces of gold? Aye, that is too much,"
she shrieks. Renshu's stomach drops. He was trying to help. He was finding a way back to Uncle.
"You were cheated! No wonder that lousy thief was so quick to push us on the boat. 1 piece for both of us would have been more than enough."
Renshu stutters,
"Ma, you said it was okay."
"I said okay?
No, I never would have said okay to such a swindle." "There was nothing else I could do. You were too sad and we had to get on this boat to find Uncle."
Meilin counts her coins again. Clink, clink.
"Ma, I'm sorry,"
Renshu whispers. Meilin swallows her next sentence and drops the rest of the coins and charms back into the box.
"My jade eggplant charm is gone too," she grumbles.
Even though he hates it when she's angry with him, relief springs up in Renshu. If she's cross, she must be coming out of her sadness. His ma is back.
Chapter 9. Shanghai, China, January 1947. Sailing into Shanghai, Meilin and Renshu gape at the European buildings along the shore. "The Bund," one of the other passengers tells them. Even after a decade of war and occupation, and now, during its struggle to rebuild, the promenade's elegance and stature are striking. Meilin sees why Wenling loves the city so much. Streets bustle with trolleys, shiny motor cars, rickshaws, jeeps. For the first time, Meilin and Renshu see people from all over the world. Europeans with light-coloured hair and eyes, Sikh policemen wearing red turbans, Americans, Russians. There are unfamiliar languages and accents to wonder at. Shanghainese is so different from Mandarin and Sichuanese that at first Meilin cannot understand it at all. Still, enough people from all over China have come to the city that Meilin can get by with a mixture of Mandarin, Sichuanese, and careful gestures. They spend 1 week and a precious gold piece to stay at an inn while they search for Longwei. It's overwhelming. All Meilin knows is that Longwei said he was now a civil servant. They ask at a few government offices. She is told civil servant is not enough of a job title. Does she know what area he works in? Does she know who his superior is? Does she have any more information? The few facts she offers aren't enough. Malin never knew what Longway did. In truth, she didn't want to know. She only knew that he worked for and revered the Generalissimo. It used to be that Da Longway had connections everywhere, but now no one seems to have heard of the man. There is a whirlpool of suggestions, but no definite answers. If he is part of the government, won't he be at the re-established capital in Nanjing? Or maybe he went to Chengdu. Or he might have gone to Taiwan to work in the government after retrocession. Changing strategy. Malin is certain Longway wouldn't be able to stay away from the enticements of gambling and drinks. She turns her attention to some of Shanghai's seedier corners. One evening, she trails government workers and off-duty nationalist officers to Madame Z's emporium. Glamorous and sophisticated, Madame Z's emporium offers something for everyone. A tea house by day where deals of all kinds occur. A shulo in the evening for storytelling and opera, boasting gramophones and dancing girls. And at night, there are rooms upstairs for pleasures with the Changsan ladies. Malin has begun to see beyond the glitter of the wealthy foreigners, beyond the chauffeurs at the Palace Hotel and the smart caps and suits, opening the doors for ladies in furs. She sees beyond the Cathay Theatre's neon lights, even beyond the sparkling, alluring strains of jazz spilling out of dance clubs and into the streets. Many here still struggle for survival. Everyday necessities are expensive and scarce. If they are going to survive, she realizes, she needs to find a job. The next afternoon, Malin returns to Madame Z's. The woman at the door is older, maybe in her early 50s, and impeccably dressed. Her suit of rich, deep maroon brocade has that unmistakable Shanghai mix of Eastern and Western styles. Her permed and dyed hair contrasts with her puffy face and cheeks. Around her thick wrists dangle jade bracelets, while gold earrings glint from her ears. "What do you want? This is a place for gentlemen," she scowls at Malin. Malin flushes and hesitates. "Are you looking for someone?" the woman demands, made suspicious by Malin's reticence. "Are you Madame Z?" Malin falters. "I'm looking for work." The woman's eyes slide over Malin, assessing her. Malin stands straighter and purses her lips. Madame Z shakes her head. "You're too old. There's nothing for you here." At that moment, one of the girls inside complains that her costume does not fit properly. Malin notices some sequins have fallen off and the hem is fraying. Madame Z glares back at the girl and curses her carelessness. "I can sew," Malin says. "I can fix your costumes and keep them tidy." She bends down to take a piece of embroidery from her bag. It is a small black silk square, something she did on the long boat ride to Shanghai. Without a plan, following the wisdom of her fingers, the embroidery had seemed to almost weave itself. Over the weeks of travel, a peach tree had appeared in full fruit with leaves in many different shades of green. She holds it out now to Madame Z. The woman takes it, squints at it, runs her fat, soft fingers along the stitches. She hands it back to Malin. "What else can you do?" Malin looks beyond Madame Z. Around the room are tables of men drinking and eating snacks. Several tables need clearing. "I can prepare food, wait tables, fix costumes. I can do many things that will keep your..." She pauses, not sure what to call the place, then recalls the sign outside, "Emporium," running smoothly. Madame Z eyes Malin again. This time, when the woman appraises her, Malin raises her chin. Her expression is respectful, but not subservient. She has offered Madame Z something she needs. Come back tomorrow. I'll think about it. Madame Z is curt, but her tone has shifted from dismissal to interest. They come to an agreement. Mei Lin will mend costumes, help supervise clients, and look after the girls. Madame Z can only offer a small wage, but Mei Lin and Ren Shu can stay at an apartment down the street in a Shu Kumen building that she also owns. The flat is small, a room and a Tingzi Dian, a tiny north-facing study, above a kitchen cold and cramped. But there is a sink and electricity. Plus, she can use scraps of cloth from the costumes to make slippers, mend Ren Shu's coat and trousers, and occasionally, when there is enough, sew new clothes. In their new rooms, Mei Lin and Ren Shu share leftovers from a banquet earlier that evening. Outside, people light paper lanterns and release them into the sky to celebrate the close of the New Year's festivities. It is the year of the pig, a symbol of wealth and plenty. They go outside to watch. As a surprise, Mei Lin produces two lanterns for them to light. It is a small extravagance, so they too can welcome the new year when hope is a habit. What do you hope for this year? Mei Lin asks Ren Shu. The boy is quiet. Mei Lin looks at him. He looks thin, too thin. Despite the hungry, restless days, he has grown. In Chongqing, she had sewed him a padded jacket that she'd been sure would last. The sleeves were too long, and he had to fold up the cuffs. Now, it barely stretches around his shoulders. Once fluffy and full, the padding is wadded flat. Where the satin has torn, cotton filling pokes out. The edges are marked with oil stains, dirt from the road, smudges where he has wiped something up or dried something off. Books, Ren Shu says. Books? His answer surprises and delights her. What kind of books? All kinds. I want to learn more. I want to take exams and go to university. Be a scholar. His wish waters her sadness for Xiao Wen and her own lost family. They would all be so delighted to see the young man he is becoming. We'll find a school for you then, she says. Though her reserves are low, she still has some cash. Education is a kind of investment, she reasons, and one she'd always wanted for him. What about you, Ma? What do you wish for? Mei Lin considers what to say, watching a lantern float into the sky. Each lantern that rises is a defiant answer to all the bombs that fell. The lanterns don't erase the loss, but they feel like a show of hope, of resilience. Though the communists and Kuomintang are fighting again in the northeast, for tonight, at least, Shanghai feels peaceful. What do you wish for? His question echoes in her mind. When was the last time, if ever, someone asked her that? When was the last time she asked herself? For so long, the answer has been one of immediacy. Shelter, food, money, safety, cloth, wood, warmth. She does need and wish for all those things. But New Year's wishes are a time to reach beyond the practical. Of course, there are the impossible things. For Xiao Wen to have returned, to have found her family, for the war to never have happened. But what does she wish for that could still be possible? How might they not just survive but flourish? An orchard, she says. An orchard? Come, let's go inside, she says. Back in their room, Mei Lin gets the scroll from her basket. It is her last connection to the future she and Xiao Wen once dreamed of. She carefully shuttles the silk from one end to the other, as if enacting a ritual, to the final scene where the traveller rests under blossoming trees. This, she points at the trees. This is what I want. Ren Shu smiles. Perhaps now is the time to tell her about the ancient orchard he discovered in Yitang and the seeds he left behind there.
Have I ever told you the story about the magic pear tree?
Malin asks, breaking his thoughts.
The magic pear tree?
He shakes his head. And before he can say another word, she starts.
There was once a farmer from a town called Bailito, not far from where I grew up. One autumn, the farmer had a splendid pear harvest. He filled his cart with fruit and made his way to the market. As the music of the story flows from his ma's tongue, Renchu fills with warmth. The cold night disappears, and he is transported into the world she conjures. She seems, for once, happy. He will tell her about the seeds later. At the market, the farmer was doing a fine business. He spent the morning exchanging those golden globes for silver coins. After each purchase, he imagined what he would buy. Strong black boots, a fur coat for winter, maybe even another donkey or a new cart. As the day went on, his purse and his dreams were growing fatter and fatter. Along came a monk. The edges of his robes were dusty and frayed. He had walked a great distance, having come over the mountains on his way to a sacred temple. Although the monk had forsaken most of his worldly desires and earthly belongings long ago, the pears looked so delicious and smelt so sweet that he hungered after one. Approaching the farmer, he said,
"Please, good sir, in your benevolence and generosity, will you give a humble monk one of your sweet pears?"
The farmer hesitated. If he gave the monk a pear, people might get the idea that he would give his fruit away for free. But he knew he shouldn't refuse a monk. So he pretended he didn't hear and hoped the monk would wander away.
"Dear brother," persisted the monk, "you would honour your family name if you shared a pear. You have plenty. Could you not spare just one?"
At that moment, the farmer was selling pears to a rich family. After pouring coins into the farmer's palm, the mother gave each of her children a pear. The farmer turned his back to the monk and battered at the air with his free hand, as if swatting a mosquito. An old tea seller nearby had been watching. She knew something about the ways of monks, so she flipped a coin in the farmer's direction.
"Give that old man a pear. Have you no shame?"
The farmer caught the coin mid-air and slipped it into his silk purse.
"Very well," the farmer said to the monk. "Have a pear."
The monk bowed to the tea seller.
"Thank you for the kindness."
Then he turned to the farmer's cart and selected a pear. He sat down in the middle of the market and bit into his pear with his eyes closed, humming with pleasure. In this manner, he ate the whole fruit, stem and all, except for one seed. Then, opening his eyes, he stood and said,
"You have many pears, but I only needed one seed."
Taking a small shovel from his sack, he dug a hole. He placed the seed in the hole and carefully covered it. He then took his begging bowl and went over to the tea seller, holding it out. Without comment, the tea seller filled the bowl. The monk poured the water where he had buried the seed. By now, a crowd had gathered to watch. From the moist spot on the ground, a shoot broke through the earth. In front of everyone's eyes, it grew and thickened into a trunk. Within minutes, the trunk divided, and branches sprouted and began to wind their way up, like arms reaching towards the sky. Cries of astonishment rang out as buds burst forth, then blossomed into full splendour. Amazement followed unfurling leaves, the blossoms folding in on themselves so that fruit began to swell and ripen. When the tree was heavy with fruit, a strong, sweet fragrance tickled everyone's noses, and newly sprung limbs bowed down under the pull of plump pears. The monk turned to the crowd and, with open arms and a deep bow, invited everyone to eat. Once everyone had enjoyed a pear or two, Malin continues, the monk clapped his hands twice. The pear tree's leaves began to change colour, then wither, dry and drop. When they had all fallen and the branches were bare, he took a small axe from his bag, chopped down the tree, put the trunk over his shoulder and walked out of the market, his robes dragging behind in the dust. Throughout these antics, the farmer stood aghast, his back to his cart. When everyone rushed to eat the monk's miraculous pears, the farmer was stunned, at a loss for words. Once the monk was gone, the market resumed its usual hubbub. The chickens, who had gone quiet in their wicker cages, began to squawk again. The vegetable sellers began bargaining once more with the thrifty old women, and dogs went back to their scampering. The farmer was about to continue selling his pears when the realization struck him like a fist in his stomach. He spun around. Sure enough, his cart was empty. Examining the front, he saw that the cart handle had been hacked away. Shouting and red-faced, the farmer ran down the street after the monk, his overfull purse spilling coins as he went. A trail of children followed behind, collecting the riches he left in his wake. When he rounded the corner where the monk had disappeared, the only thing he saw was his cart handle lying in the middle of the empty road. Renshu laughs. A thunderous boom breaks the air. Renshu, look! Fireworks! Beyond the rising lanterns, high up in the sky, a dazzle of sparks and spirals. Then another, and another. Again and again, the thump of the launch, the whoosh of the rockets, then a bloom of colour, lighting up the sky. They watch until the final flash shimmers and only smoky ghosts of fleeting brilliance remain. Each day, after Renshu goes to school, Malin heads to the Emporium. In the mornings, she helps prepare food. In the afternoons, she serves customers tea. As the evening clientele float in, Malin goes home to Renshu. She turns around the mending so quickly that Madame Z has nothing to complain about. Although it's an unsavoury place, it's practical. It's strategic. If she's going to find Longwei anywhere, it will be here. Malin is starting to recognise some regular customers. Among the Emporium's patrons are literati, intellectuals and art dealers, alongside civil servants and off-duty officers. Whatever their politics, they all come to drink tea, eat snacks and debate. Frequently, the art dealers produce small treasures, fishing for a sale. Malin has seen ornate jewellery, carved boxes, bright baubles and jade charms changing hands. One seller, Mr. Lee, often trades in scrolls. He wears gold-rimmed glasses and his slick hair is parted in the middle. Though he's articulate and well-mannered, he's not always honest. She lingers when he enrolls one of his wares for a prospective buyer, listening in on the negotiations. From what she's seen of his collection, she knows her own scroll is much finer. There's also Mr. Xu, a big man with a broad nose, silver-tipped hair and a smoker's cough. She's not sure what his job is, but he has a hearty laugh and is friendly to everyone. Most of the men don't even see her, but Mr. Xu jokes with Mei Lin when she brings more hot water for tea or clears away the plates. Occasionally, he winks at her. She has to admit she likes the attention. Today, Mr. Zhu is arguing with Mr. Li. She listens intently, hoping to hear a mention of Longwei.
Now that the Kuomintang have captured Yan'an, no doubt the nationalists will prevail. How can the communists continue without their capital? Mr. Li says. The CCP still has great support among the peasantry. Many still haven't forgiven the nationalists for their corruption during the war, Mr. Xu counters. But the Kuomintang have the treasury, the cities, even the army. Even if there's support for the communists, they don't have the resources. It's inconceivable they could overcome the KMT.
Unlikely, Mr. Xu agrees, but not impossible.
Mr. Li scoffs and finishes his tea in a single gulp. He catches Mei Lin's eye and signals that he wants more hot water. She heads to the kitchen, leaving them to their conversation. Months pass, but Long Wei never turns up. Although Mei Lin doesn't stop looking for him, the hope of reuniting grows fainter and fainter. Still, Mei Lin and Renshu are making a kind of life here. Madame Z's trust in and estimation of Mei Lin grows. "Dancing girls," says Madame Z, "come and go like willow leaves blowing down the road in autumn. But a seamstress as good as Mei Lin, now that is a rare find." Madame Z is happy as long as Mei Lin keeps the costumes bright and alluring. All that sparkle attracts the men and their bulging wallets away from the troubles of the world outside. Shanghai, China, April 1948. As the year of the pig turns into the year of the rat, whatever sense of security Mei Lin and Renshu have cultivated begins to disintegrate. Inflation has spiraled out of control. A black market thrives, and frustration with the government's mishandling of the economy simmers. More and more protests spring up in the streets. Uneasy and losing faith in the nationalists, foreigners are returning to their homelands. At the Emporium, business is starting to dwindle. Initially, Madame Z broadcasts a brash confidence.
"Regardless of politics, all men have the same appetites," she says.
But in the spring, when the communists retake Yan'an and much of the north, fewer and fewer customers come through the door. The regulars become sporadic in their visits. When they do come, they tend to drink too much. With each report of more territory lost, more soldiers fallen, Mr. Li waves his hands in disbelief.
"The Kuomintang had the bigger army and better resources. How can they have lost their advantages?" he exclaims.
"Ha," Mr. Xu blusters, signalling Mei Lin to bring another bottle of brandy.
"It's because the KMT have left too much destruction and discontent in their wake. They have lost the people's allegiance. Maybe in the countryside, but you can't really believe the communists could gain the cities,"
Li presses as he empties his glass. "Not possible. Not possible," Mr. Guo, another regular, mutters.
Mei Lin lingers to hear more of the discussion, but is soon called away by other customers. A few weeks later, Mei Lin and Renshu are walking back towards the Shikumen. As they pass a fabric store, Mei Lin notices that the price on a bolt of red silk that caught her eye that morning has been crossed out and rewritten several times. It has nearly quadrupled during the day. Renshu is talking about his school. Last year, it was a haven. For a few hours a day, he could immerse himself in his learning and friends. But now, classmates are disappearing. They come to school one day and don't come back the next. Rumours say that those from wealthier families have been whisked away to stay with relatives in Hong Kong, Taiwan, even America. A convoy of military jeeps pass, honking their horns to clear the way. Renshu watches thoughtfully.
"Maybe I should become a soldier," he says. "Some of my classmates have quit school to join the army."
"Absolutely not," Mei Lin cries. "You're only 14. What are you thinking?"
"But Ma, you work so hard. If I joined the army, I could earn money to help. I'd have a good uniform too."
"Renshu, after all that we have been through, I can't lose you too."
"We're okay here. We have food. We have a place to stay. It's not so bad, right?" She grasps his hand. He shrugs and shakes his hand free. Ahead is a crowded square. Mei-Lin can see people handing out flyers. She doesn't know which side they are on, CCP or KMT. Either way, she decides to steer Renshu away. They take a shortcut through an alleyway and pass an antique shop. Mei-Lin recognizes Mr. Lee inside. At the corner, she glances up to note the intersection and they continue home. In the autumn, the government calls for all citizens to hand over any gold, silver or foreign coins in an attempt to stabilize the currency. While it's now illegal to have gold, this only makes people hold on to what they have even more tightly. The economy continues to deteriorate. The nationalist government is losing what little control remains. Mei-Lin hears that the CCP is recruiting new members, even as suspected communists are shot dead, point blank, in the streets. It is as dangerous an atmosphere as Mei-Lin can ever remember. Much more poisonous than the Chongqing days. At least then, it was clear who the enemy were. They flew planes with white flags and red suns. Now, it's not so easy to know. Last week, Mei-Lin saw someone in a Kuomintang uniform knocking on doors all down the lane, collecting names, occupations, and activities of residents. She didn't answer when he rapped at her door. Now, many of those neighbours are missing. Some of them were even government supporters. Who knows who that man in the uniform was? When there are spies for both parties everywhere, the best strategy is to be invisible. One morning, in late November, Mei-Lin arrives at the Emporium to a scene of chaos. Tables are overturned, girls are crying. Mei-Lin drops the costume she has mended and runs over to the wailing Madame Z. "What happened?" she cries.
"A raid! A raid! Oh, my beautiful emporium!"
"When?" Madame Z is cursing and mumbling and pacing around. After many questions and half answers, Mei-Lin pieces together that the night before, a group of CCP members burst in and dragged away many patrons, including some of the lower-ranking KMT officers. Their fate? Probably to be questioned, tortured and killed.
"How? Who?" Mei-Lin stutters. "Mr. Xu, that putrid, festering pig testicle is a communist!" Madame Z spits in disgust. "He was spying on us all along!"
Mei-Lin's stomach drops.
"Mr. Xu?"
For so long, Madame Z had remained sanguine, but now she's hysterical. She's packing up. She's leaving her beloved city.
"Where are you going?"
Madame holds up her hands, bare of rings and bracelets.
"America. I sold my jewels for a ticket."
Mei-Lin doesn't have gold to sell like Madame. What will she do?
"Madame, can you help us, please?" she begs. "I can't. I don't have anything to spare."
Then she pauses.
"When I got my tickets this morning, there were still some for the Taiping next week, heading to Taiwan. Maybe you can get some. Either way, you must leave Shanghai, Mei-Lin. Mr. Xu,"
and here she lets off another string of obscenities,
"is sure to have marked this place, the Shukuman, and everyone here. There is no time. Get out."
After school, Renshu is heading home when someone calls to him, waving, "Hey, you're Mei-Lin's boy, aren't you?" The speaker is a big man with short hair, silvery at the tips, a wide nose and a cough. Renshu doesn't say anything.
"Cautious. I like that. It's a good quality," the man says. "It means you're a good judge of character. But there's no need to be suspicious. I know your ma from Madame Z's. Maybe she's mentioned me. I'm Xu Deming, Mr. Xu."
Renshu squints at Mr. Xu. Isn't he the one his ma says will sometimes slip her an extra coin?
"See, I knew you'd know me," Mr. Xu says, his voice polishing over Renshu's uncertainty. "I have an opportunity for you."
Mr. Xu glances around.
Renshu looks too. There are few passers-by on the street.
Mr. Shu steps closer to Renshu. You know this civil war is very serious. We are fighting for the soul of our country. The Red Army is approaching Shanghai. Some say it's only a matter of days before they arrive and take control.
Renshu nods.
I can give you a job that will help you and your ma stay safe.
Over the past few weeks, his ma has been increasingly worried as business has dropped off at the Emporium. What's the job?
Renshu asks. He'll be my assistant. He'll help make China strong again. Working with me would be an act of great patriotism. You're nearly a man now. You need to look after your ma.
Mr. Shu smiles broadly and holds out his chubby hands.
So, do you want the job?
Back at the Shu Kumen, Mei Lin is trying to calm herself and come up with a plan. Taiwan? Really? A tiny island Mei Lin knows nothing about? There must be other options. Hong Kong? Train tickets would be easier and cheaper to get. They might even be able to make it on foot at least part of the way. No. Hong Kong is too risky. It would take too long, and train tracks are too vulnerable. Besides, in Hong Kong, they wouldn't have the ocean separating them from the communists. Taiwan, then. Who knows? Maybe Long Wei will be there, if he's still alive. But how is she going to get two tickets? She goes into their small study and retrieves her basket from its hiding place. She opens her wooden box. All that remains is a single gold coin. It's nowhere near enough. She picks up the scroll. Ma? Ma, where are you? Renshu is home. She puts the scroll back in the basket and exhales, closing her eyes briefly as she prepares to tell Renshu they will, once again, be leaving. Ma! Ma, I have good news. Someone has offered me a job. Alarm bells go off in Mei Lin's head. This does not sound like good news. Any composure she had corralled moments before skitters away. What? Who have you been talking to? Don't you know not to trust strangers?
No, not a stranger, Ma. Your friend, Mr. Shu. You said he was the kindest and funniest of all the customers.
Mei Lin's mouth goes dry. What did you say?
He said I needed to talk to you first, of course. We agreed to meet again tomorrow.
Did you tell him where we live? Mei Lin barely whispers. Her heart is thudding in her ears.
He didn't ask.
Were you followed home?
Renshu looks over his shoulder. I don't know. I don't think so.
Ma, what's wrong?
I thought you liked him. I can help us earn more money.
He's a spy. Mei Lin is hysterical. She can no longer keep it in. He's a spy for the communists. There was a raid at Madame Z's this morning and he was behind it.
Renshu gasps. You are too trusting, Renshu. We've got to leave Shanghai as soon as possible.
Because of me?
No, not because of you, she reassures him, attempting to muffle her panic. Because it's not safe here anymore. Because it's time.
That evening, Mei Lin puts on a silk qipao, borrowed from Madame Z's costumes. It's plum-coloured, with peonies. Her hair is in a chignon, high on her head to show off the lines of her neck. In her basket, she carries the scroll.
Renshu, stay here, in the study. Don't answer the door for anyone. Don't put the lights on in the main room. That window is visible from the street.
Where are you going?
I have a small errand. Promise me you won't open the door. Promise?
He nods solemnly. Her outburst earlier has frightened him. The streets are busy outside. Night vendors frying eggs in hot iron pots. Rickshaws rattling past, followed by the occasional car. Further out, Mei Lin can hear the shouts of the military troops. Lights flash. She heads for Mr. Lee's. Inside, the shop is small but luxurious. Display cabinets are filled with delicate snuff bottles, serving platters, cloisonné vases, and carved wooden Ruyi's scepters. Near the front counter, he has a display of jade charms that Mei-Lin studies. In her finery, she is certain he doesn't recognize her. A few other customers browse the Santai ceramics and porcelain figures. One by one, they leave. When she is the only customer left, Mei-Lin asks Mr. Li if he has any hand scrolls or landscape paintings. He glances out the window. It's dark, and the streets are emptying of possible customers.
"In my office," he says,
and motions for her to follow him to a back room. The room has elegant tiled floors, a low rosewood kang table in the centre, and a tall black lacquer display cabinet with brass fittings at the side. On the walls hang several scrolls depicting landscapes. In one corner is a basket holding many more scrolls, rolled up. In the other, a fire crackles in a wood stove.
"Please," he says, gesturing at the walls.
Mei-Lin walks the perimeter, contemplating each scroll. The room is warm, so she takes off her jacket and drapes it over her arm, covering her basket. She considers a painting of pines on the riverbank, mountains towering behind. A peasant and donkey cross a bridge in the foreground. The artwork is good, but not as good as her scroll. "What's the price?"
"I keep it simple," he says. "Pay me in gold bullion, any currency, but it must weigh 2 liang.
She nods and moves on to the next painting, a crane standing in long grasses. "And this?"
"Also 2 liang. Do you have gold?"
His impatience cracks his veneer of refinement. "Actually, I come to sell, not buy." Her heart pings as she takes her scroll from her basket and hands it to him to inspect. He eagerly unrolls it until its ends dangle off the kang and touch the cold floor. She has never looked at it fully unrolled. It feels like a betrayal to see it fully exposed, all its mysteries laid bare. She wants to shield it from his eyes and hands, but she restrains herself. Despite his attempt at indifference, he cannot hide his admiration.
2 liang,
he offers. She scoffs. It is nowhere near enough. But this is only the beginning of the negotiation. They both know this.
Pah! He must give me at least 8. Look at the careful detail, the quality of the silk, the excellent calligraphy. Are you mad? 8 liang is a bargain. I should be asking 10.
He smirks, amused by her spirit.
3 liang, but no more.
Back and forth, back and forth. She bargains him up to 4, but she knows she needs more. How can you say 4 is fair when you're asking 2 liang for those? She waves at the scrolls on the wall. You know they are nowhere near the quality of mine. Mine is a much finer work. A fair exchange. All I ask for is a fair exchange. He tilts his head in recognition.
I know you. You're from Madame Z's Emporium.
His expression has shifted from hard-bargaining art dealer to something else. She's seen this look on men who come to the Emporium for the Changsan girls. He moistens his lips. She shivers as she feels his eyes gliding over her dress.
So, you want some gold for this scroll of yours, which is, I admit, very, very beautiful.
He comes around to stand right next to her. Fumes of tobacco and sweat rise from his skin.
But we can't agree on a price.
He turns, then traces a finger along her cheek and jawbone.
For 8 liang, don't you have anything else to offer?
Even though it's warm in the room, goosebumps prickle her arm. She knows what he wants. Of course she knows. Some part of her knew when she walked into the shop, when she put on the qipao with the long zip and high leg slits, even when she discovered his shop weeks ago.
It's nearly closing time. I will go get your money. I feel sure we are going to come to an agreement soon, he says.
She hears him in the front of the shop, pulling down the shades. Keys jangle as he locks the door. Get out. Leave. There must be another way, a different way to get what she needs. She kneels and starts to roll up the scroll, swiftly but carefully, not wanting to damage it. She keeps an eye on the door. She'll have to squeeze by as quickly as she can. As she's tying the tassel, a hand grips her shoulder from behind. Startled, she drops the scroll and it clatters to the floor, partially unrolling. He has entered the room through a different door. Then he's grabbing her wrist and pinning her arm behind her back, his voice calm and genial. I think we found a fair price. He's pushing up the fabric of her dress, pulling her underwear down. Pain shoots along her shoulder. She focuses on the pain, unwilling to acknowledge what else is happening. Just when she thinks her arm is about to snap, he lets go. Relief barely registers before her cheek is pressed hard against the rosewood she admired before. A strong hand holds her head down and another unzips her dress, pulls it off. He is groping her breasts, her buttocks, pulling her thighs apart. She wants to kick or scream or push him away. She can't. She's captured in her own body, frozen. Terror eclipses her pain. Her pulse was racing when her head hit the desk, but now everything slows. Her limbs are like a rag doll's. He flips her over, and then he's on top of her. She turns her face away and stares at the motionless blades of a ceiling fan. When he penetrates her, there is a sharp, piercing pain, then a terrible, creeping coldness. She is not here. She is not here. He's grunting. Her back skids and chafes along the table. There is a rhythmic scraping of table legs on the tile floor. She still cannot move. After a massive, rough shove, he shudders and groans. He is bent, lying on her, trapping her. Again and again, her eyes trace the shape of the fan blades. Finally, he pulls away. She drops back down into her body. Her back hurts, her thighs hurt, her arms ache, her groin is numb. She cannot stop shaking. She hears him panting. She senses where he is in the room, but she can't, won't, look at him.
There's your fair exchange, he says,
and she sees his hands pick up her scroll from the floor. She sits and cradles her face with her hand, touching her mouth, her cheekbones, her eye sockets, as if checking to see if she is complete. Still shaking, she clasps her hands together and blows on her fingers. It doesn't help. Her shoes are still on. She pulls her underwear back up, retrieves her dress. The fire snaps and sputters. Somehow, she gets herself dressed, puts her jacket back on, finds her basket. On the table, he sets down a silk purse. The coins inside clink. She reaches for the purse. It is nauseatingly heavy.
Go now, he says.
She watches her feet, willing each one to move. One step, another step. She is concentrating on the designs of the floor tiles. She is almost at the door. The door squeaks as he opens it. There are rats scuttling in the alley. It is so cold outside. She retches against the building, shuddering, shuddering. Then, slowly, she makes her way back to Renshu. Chapter 10. Harbour of Shanghai, China, December 1948. They stand on the deck of the Taiping. People crowd in front and behind, making room where there is none. Renshu, a full head taller than Mei Lin, stays close, sheltering her, protecting their space. It would be easy for fingers to wander into pockets. A bag set down by one pair of hands is likely to be picked up by another. Behind the drifting silhouettes of the sampans and fishing boats, lights glimmer on the shore. A never-ending crowd stretches from the end of the dock back towards the Bund. People cry and wail, begging for just one more boat to ferry them to the steamer. Earlier, on the small boat Mei-Lin and Renshu caught, the boatman refused to leave until everyone discarded something from their suitcases. Clothing, books, and mementos accumulated as families agonized over what to keep, what to leave. Anticipating moments like this, Mei-Lin had tossed down a red satin bag of costume jewellery from the Emporium. A man, probably in cahoots with the boat's owner, gathered the castaway items. Even with the lightened load, waves still threatened to capsize the craft. Icy salt water sloshed over their shoes. Hurrying up a wobbly ramp, they boarded the Taiping. Mei-Lin's goal had only been enough for deck spots. Cabin tickets were too costly. Most of the other passengers on the deck are male. The few families Mei-Lin saw earlier have disappeared. Perhaps they were able to afford cabins. Feeling vulnerable,